Good afternoon, and welcome to Line 1, Your Health Connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Prentice Pemberton. During the late 1800s and early 1900s, the U.S. government engaged in a campaign to civilize and educate the Alaska Native people. In the 1930s and 40s, they ramped up this assimilation process by shipping thousands of young children from all over Alaska to boarding schools hundreds or even thousands of miles from their homes. Children as young as 4 or 5 were forcibly taken from their parents and loaded onto planes, skiffs, and dog teams. Knowing nothing of why they were taken or if they would ever see their parents again, they were forced to learn English and taught the beliefs of Christianity. Many were beaten for speaking their native languages, sexually abused by caregivers, emotionally traumatized, and taught to be ashamed of their culture and traditions. These same children have grown up and are now elders in communities all over Alaska. While many have been able to recover and have gone on to lead successful lives, others have never spoken of these events, much less healed from them. Left in the wake of these atrocities is a legacy of lost identity, addiction, and abuse. The scars of the trauma inflicted on entire nations of people are living on in their children, grandchildren, and now great-grandchildren. The Alaskan story of intergenerational trauma is not an isolated event. America's abduction and enslavement of African people, the Holocaust, and the genocide of American Indians are but a few examples of events that have and will continue to shape groups of people for generations. Lakota social worker Dr. Maria Yellowhorse Braveheart describes historical trauma as the cumulative emotional and psychological wounding over the lifespan and across generations which emanates from massive group trauma. Well, joining me today to discuss historical trauma is Kyle Wark from the First Alaskans Institute. Kyle is originally from Hoonah, Alaska, one of the largest Tlingit communities in the world at approximately 800 people. Kyle's first educators were his Tlingit elders who told him traditional and personal stories and included him in Tlingit cultural activities and subsistence practices. Kyle received an undergraduate degree in Western Classics from St. John's College in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and later returned to St. John's to earn a master's degree in Eastern Classics. Kyle earned a second master's degree in anthropology with an emphasis on his Tlingit culture from the University of Alaska, Anchorage. I appreciate you taking the time to join us today, Kyle.
Thanks for having me.
I want to take just a second to remind our listeners how we can be reached. You can call us locally at 550-8433 or reach us on our toll-free number at 1-888-353-5752. And you can email your questions, as always, to line1@alaskapublic.org. You got to spell out line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E. Okay, Kyle, I guess let's get a little bit back to your experience and research in the field of historical trauma and a little bit about what the First Alaskans Institute is all about.
Thank you. First Alaskans is an Alaska Native-focused nonprofit, 501c3. We were founded around 2001 to engage in original research, policy advocacy, community dialogues, leadership development, including an internship program and fellowships that we send down to D.C. and Juneau to work in the legislature. We have a community engagement piece that publishes First Alaskans magazine, and we also do a little bit of grant writing for rural communities, especially for cultural continuation, elder and youth involvement, and that type of thing. I work in the Alaska Native Policy Center, and we've been doing a lot of work around historic trauma, cultural trauma, collective traumas, and a bunch of related fields, especially the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study, where we've been working a lot with the Alaska Children's Trust, and our partners in the MARC grant, Mobilizing Action for Resilient Communities, including the Matsu Health Foundation and a group down in the Southern Kenai focused based in Homer. So ACEs is looking at individual traumatic experiences in childhood and the long-term effects that can have on people later in life, which ties a lot into historic trauma, and I'll be talking more about that later.
Yeah, we'll get into the ACEs program a little bit later on.
Yeah.
So what was it that sort of drew you to this area or this field of study of historical trauma? I know you grew up in Hoonah, which is a community. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about that and maybe pronounce Tlingit correctly for
yeah.
our listeners.
So Tlingit people, that's the official way to say it, Tlingit. We've known about these types of issues for a very long time. When I was a little kid, my grandpa would tell me traditional stories about Raven, about how Raven taught salmon how to dive by putting a little rock in their head, and how Raven stole the sun and the moon and the stars from a box from an old man at the head of the Nass River. And I learned a lot from these stories, but he also told me about his life growing up. So when I was 4 years old, he sat me down at his knee and told me about his first day at boarding school. And he told me that they had school up to eighth grade in Hoonah in the, what would that be, the 1920s and 30s when he was a little boy. And when you graduated, you could stop or you could go on. And his parents decided they wanted him to get a high school education, so they sent him down to Wrangell Institute. And his first day there, he said that he was sitting there by his bunk. He really didn't know quite what to expect. And a boy a couple of bunks down, he called him an Eskimo. That was the term they used then. He noticed they kind of caught each other's eye. And this young boy took a chewing gum wrapper and rolled it up and flicked it at him. And it hit his shoulder and bounced down. And he kind of looked at it, picked it up, and threw it back. He thought he was just saying hello. And this older boy came up to him, one of the dorm supervisors, an 18-year-old boy, and he said to my grandpa, "Pick that up." And my grandpa said, "Well, it's not mine. I was just throwing it back at him." And the older boy said, "Pick that up." And my grandpa said, "No, it's not mine." And the boy walked away, and he never really thought about it. That night, he was asleep in his bed, and he felt somebody shaking him on the shoulder. And he kind of woke up and looked, and he saw that dorm supervisor looking at him. He said, "Come with me." And he took him downstairs to the dean's office, the principal, whatever you call it. And the dean said, "I'm going to send you home for insubordination. Do you know what that is?" And my grandpa said, "No." He said, "You disobeyed a direct order. One of my boys told you to do something and you didn't do it." And my grandpa was thinking, if I go home now, I'm going to embarrass my family. They're all going to think I wasn't smart enough. I failed on the first day. Who fails on the first day? And so he said, "Is there anything that I can do to stay here?" And the dean looked at him and said, "Well, do you see these seven older boys here?" And they were the other dorm supervisors, all 18-year-old boys, big boys. My grandpa was ninth grade, 13. He said, "You can fight them, box them, 1 minute round apiece. And if you can box them all, you can stay here." So my grandpa put on the boxing gloves and fought seven one-minute matches with boys far older and bigger than he was so that he could stay at school. So even at a very early age, I recognized that there were these terrible things that had happened to our peoples, even before I really became aware of almost anything else, woven into the history of my people, just like Raven, just like the stories of when salmon could talk and walk around. There was this understanding that these terrible things had happened to us, and they affected how he grew up and how he lived his life, and they were things that he wanted me to understand. Later on, my mom was an alcoholic, and she was an alcoholic pretty much all my life, and I struggled with that for a very long time. It caused me a lot of pain, and I've had to receive a lot of help to get through it. In 2010, she died from a lifetime of chronic alcohol abuse. She wasn't drinking currently. The alcohol had poisoned her heart. It makes the muscle tissue weak. They call it alcoholic cardiomyopathy. And it just gave out. It gets bigger and weaker. And it just quit one day while she was sitting on a recliner in her living room. And when I found out about that, I was in graduate school. And I started thinking about, what does this mean to me? You know, I've struggled with mom's drinking my whole life, but what happened to her? I started writing a research paper based on that question, what happened to my mom? And it turned into, it was like a 15-page assignment, and I wrote 40 pages. I said at the time, this is not even a quarter of what I wanted to say. And I was telling one of my thesis advisors about this, and she said, "Kyle, why are you doing this other topic?" I was looking at Tlingit land use. She said, "You've written half a thesis. Just why don't you just expand on that?" And I did. And instead of writing 80 pages, I wrote 300 because I'm an overachiever. But really, it was about I didn't care about the requirements for my master's degree. I knew that they only needed 80 pages from me. What I cared about was what I needed to heal and what I needed to put my what I needed to feel comfortable about putting my name on and saying, this is what I have to say about Tlingit people and alcohol. I couldn't put out a half measure. I couldn't put out something that I didn't believe in. And so I felt the need to complete all those things that I wrote about. And that really introduced me a lot to this topic of historic trauma, as well as my work with First Alaskans. We'd been involved with that adverse childhood experiences stuff from, you know, practically the first day that I got on board in 2012. In December 2012 was when I joined. And early 2013, I was already doing stuff with adverse childhood experiences and historic trauma. So it's been a part of my entire career at FAI. It's been a huge part of my academic journey. I only finished that thesis in 2014. It just really informs a lot of the work that we do around racial equity and educational equity, legal equity, all these different things that Alaska Natives struggle with, the high rates that we have of serving in jail, of serving in foster care systems and things like that. All of that gets tied back to these issues of historic trauma and what happened to our ancestors and what's continuing to be done to us today.
So it sounds like you didn't have much choice but to study historical drama. It's sort of you were into it from a very young age and saw how it impacted your family and your community.
Yeah, I was born into it. Later on, my great aunt told me that her dad, my great grandpa, went to a boarding school, and that probably would have been in the late 1800s, something like that. And he was hurt so badly in that he screamed out, I'm going to name my kid Kelly so that I can beat him every day. Hmm. And that level of pain, I don't know if he did that. I don't believe that he did, but he did name my grandpa Kelly. but that informed a lot of his parenting. And so it's not just all of my lifetime. I wasn't just born into it. I was born into a long chain of it.
It wasn't just your grandfather, right?
Yeah.
And he was fortunate, or I guess I wouldn't say fortunate, but he didn't go until he was older, so he didn't have those early childhood exposure to the trauma that these younger 4 and 5 year olds, I cannot imagine the confusion and the lack of understanding of what's happening to you if you're taken far away and you've never been outside your village other than, you know, to visit the next village, and you go to this culture shock, and you get exposed to things that you don't understand.
Yeah, the amount of confusion when you're a young child like that, who's, you know, your primary language is your Alaska Native language, your primary experiences with your family, everyone you've ever met up until that point is basically a relative. You know, a lot of our villages, we're all related to each other, and being thrown out of that into this context where you don't speak anything of what the other people are saying. If you speak your language, you're hurt, sometimes horrifically, sometimes less stringently. And just like you were saying, you know, no understanding of why. You know, it's not an education at that point. You know, you're not learning anything. You're being conditioned and you're being beaten down. You're being told, don't stand up, don't disobey, you know, don't be different.
And you learn, or I guess you're taught that it's your fault, and the things that you're used to and you've been taught all along are wrong and not okay.
And the things that you know are inherently wrong that are being done to you, you're told those are okay.
Right.
That being hit is okay. That being abused is okay. That this is normal. Yeah.
Okay, well, we could probably talk about this all day, but we do want to get into a little bit of the context of or put historical trauma into context. So when the description I used at the beginning is fairly good, but can you sort of expand on that, what historical trauma is? When we say historical trauma, what are we talking about?
Yeah, I think one of the key phrases that I latch onto in my mind that I've heard a lot in this type of work is that hurt people hurt people. Mm. And so when you've gone through a horrific trauma, like a massacre, if you're a survivor of the Holocaust, if you've been to one of these boarding schools and survived it, those things leave a mark, and that'll impact you the rest of your life. There's a lot of similarities with PTSD, and in fact, a lot of people who go through that initial experience could get diagnosed with PTSD, and that's going to post-traumatic stress disorder. And that's going to produce behaviors that are very harmful to you and the people around you, like substance abuse, mental health issues. Many people who have PTSD struggle with suicide or suicidality. Many of them have been incarcerated, experience episodes of violence, or they get violent towards their family or their children. And so if they have children, when they become parents, a lot of those traumatized behaviors affect their children. Their children get traumatized from being raised by a traumatized person. And in fact, there are even studies that show that if you're pregnant and a woman, if you're pregnant, when you undergo those traumas, that's going to directly affect your baby. There are even some reports that say if you've got one of these intense experiences of trauma when you're pregnant, that's almost as bad as drinking, as fetal alcohol syndrome, being born to a traumatized mother, which is just extraordinary to think about how profound that physiological change is to have undergone trauma, that it's as bad as drinking when you're pregnant. Many of their children will respond to their traumas the same way that their parents did, with substance abuse, mental health issues, violence, all these types of things. And that'll kind of perpetuate the cycle, even if a number of those kids are resilient and don't develop PTSD or find healthy ways of coping with their stress. Enough people will respond like their parents did that this sort of thing will be perpetuated.
Okay. For anybody who's tuning in late, my guest today is Kyle Wart from the First Alaskans Institute. Our topic today is historical trauma. You can reach us with your questions or comments about this topic at our local phone number. That's 550-8433. Call us toll free at 1-888-353-5752 or email us your questions or comments to line1@alaskapublic.org. Okay, so some of the terms, I mean, you talked about post-traumatic stress disorder. That's a pretty well, that's a common term known for a lot of people. But then when we're talking about transgenerational trauma, intergenerational trauma, collective trauma, that's, PTSD is the actual response that we have to a traumatic event. Like I think of Vietnam veterans and or Vietnam folks that were in Vietnam or the Iraqi wars now that are going on, and the exposure to violence and to this prolonged exposure to trauma. But it happened, when we talk about collective trauma, as a group. And so I guess the Vietnam era could be thought of, and I guess is thought of, as a historical trauma to some degree, which then it gets passed down. So can you talk a little bit about some of those terms, intergenerational, collective trauma?
Yeah. To my mind, many of them are synonymous. I think to people who work in this field, psychologists, counselors, and things like that, there are some technical differences that I don't quite understand. But I think there are some advantages and disadvantages to some of these terms. Like historic trauma, when a lot of people hear that, they think, oh, in the past, like it's already done with. They don't realize that what historic trauma means is that it's an ongoing perpetuation of these history of traumas, and that it's continuing down the line as this inheritance. And so terms like transgenerational trauma, intergenerational trauma, to my mind, there's a small advantage there, because then you understand it's coming down through the generations, or it's an inheritance from your ancestors, and it doesn't quite sound as much like it's in the past. Collective trauma, I like, because it shows that these aren't just individual problems, that when you've got a traumatized individual in your household or in your community, that's going to affect everybody. That's not just going to affect the immediate family or the people that are closest to them. It's going to affect everybody. If you've got people who can't show up for their jobs, can't hold a job, who are draining resources from because they need supports, because they need help, that's going to affect everybody. That's going to affect the whole state. And PTSD, it's accurate, but I think there's something kind of misleading about it, because it is highly individualistic. It's just this one person, whereas historic trauma, like you were saying, affects the whole community, and like I've been talking about. PTSD often also focuses on one traumatic event, like a car bomb that went off, or a massacre, an experience of being tortured, and all of those are horrific. But historic trauma typically results from many traumatic events, and oftentimes ongoing effects, like continuing oppression, continuing chronic difficulties in marginalization and suppression and discrimination and all these other things that Alaska Native people have experienced, American Indian people, African Americans, other, you know, Indigenous peoples in Canada and Australia and New Zealand. A lot of these effects, you know, they've been going on for hundreds of years, having our land taken away from us slowly, slowly, slowly by the treaties, that type of thing.
So PTSD, the trauma impacts the individual, and then we need to discuss a little bit secondary trauma. And that's where this sort of transgenerational, the impacts on the next generation and the next generation. So secondary trauma, can you explain that for listeners?
Yeah. So a lot of the literature on secondary trauma is around therapists, healthcare providers, counselors. It can also apply to first responders like firemen and police officers, people who are dealing with trauma all the time, nurses, doctors. When you get exposed to other people being in these intense emotional states, these intense traumatized states, that has an effect on you and that wears down on you. If you're a counselor and you're listening to people's problems over and over and over again, day by day by day, that begins to take a toll on you. And it's harder to remember good things. It's harder to remember how to be happy. And you need to be able to take some time out of that and take care of yourself. So oftentimes, counselors and therapists see counselors and therapists of their own. First responders, you know, they can't just be on the job all the time. They need time off. They need time to spend with their family. And that's also true for children who are living in traumatized households. If their parents are traumatized, or if they have to often hear these stories about traumatic things that happen, like Indian kids who are told about the loss of our land, the loss of our culture, the loss of our language, the loss of our clothing, our family structures, hearing about those traumas can be traumatic. And young Indian kids who are growing up in a reservation, even if their parents aren't traumatized, they're aware that this is not how our ancestors were. And that's a type of secondary trauma. That's a type of historic trauma that can be imposed on people and weigh us down. And there's actually some scales that have been developed, like the historic loss scale, that just measures how often do you think about not having your language? How often do you think about not being able to hunt the fish and game that your ancestors did in the way that they did, you know, as freely as they did? And it turns out a lot of Indian people think about those things all the time. And that has an effect on us. That's a type of secondary trauma where we're aware of these losses and what we should have and the injustice of those situations.
Okay, we got a couple of phone calls, and I don't want to make folks wait too long. So let's go to Mary. You're on the air with Kyle.
Thanks. I appreciate your taking my call. I've been doing some of my own personal research recently about the Irish potato famine, which is how my grandmother came over to the United States from Ireland. And it's been 170 years since the blight that hit Ireland affected certainly the peasant classes. And the Irish population has never rebounded. It's still three-quarters of what it was before the blight hit, and it's not because Irish Catholics are such big believers in family planning. And, compared to England or Wales, in the same amount of time, their population has doubled. Mm-hmm. And what I think is what sort of strikes me listening to you talk and, you know, sort of just knowing about my own family story is that the way this gets transmitted, I think, has a lot to, well, for example, the song "O Danny Boy" is not an Irish song. People in Ireland don't really know that song. It's an Irish immigrant song. And the line about, "Oh, come ye back when summer's in the meadow," that's wishful thinking. They're not coming back. They're gone. And, you know, it's not like today you can get on a plane and fly to Europe. They're just gone, gone. And so the Irish story that of immigration is very traumatic. And I think a lot of people, well, I'm finding that connection, and I find it very interesting.
All right. Thanks a lot for the call, Mary. I appreciate it. That's a great, great comment.
Yeah, it's definitely, you know, it's very worthwhile to point out that historic trauma is something that's happened to a wide variety of peoples for a wide variety of reasons. And it's not just something that's stuck with immigrant communities. I mean, Hurricane Katrina, the Sandy storm that just went through the East Coast, a lot of these 9/11 big traumas that we've had in recent American history are going to have profound influences on the American people in much the same way that genocide and boarding schools and things like that have had impacts on the Jewish community, the American Indian community, and so on. In fact, some of the research that I was doing in preparation for the show was talking about 9/11, and not just 9/11 first responders, but people who lived in that area. In fact, some of those pregnancy studies I was mentioning earlier were looking at mothers who lived very close to the World Trade Center on 9/11 and the impact that that trauma had on their babies.
And I think that's a great point about the Irish potato famine. There's a lot of people lost and children lost and families torn apart and migration out in order to find food and shelter. And so you lost a lot of history and a lot of remarkable people. And I think that impacts an entire culture for a long period of time. That's what it just never rebounded. It hasn't come back. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's go to another caller real quick. We have Sheila. You're on the air with Kyle.
Hi. Yes, I just have a question about having a baby as the product of rape, and how does that trickle down, you know, in utero to that baby? Are they just destined to be damaged? Is there anything you could do to replace that, to help that child?
Yeah, that's certainly a difficult case, and that is somewhat different from these types of issues that we're talking about here, insofar as the trauma happened right at the moment of conception, whereas in some of these other traumas, you know, either the trauma happens before or long before that couple has children, or it happens after the child has already been conceived and growing up and the mother experiences trauma. So I don't know if the physiology is the same. I certainly understand that the act of trauma is going to affect that woman psychologically, and the relationship that she's going to build up with her child is going to be affected by that circumstance. And that can make it difficult to bond with the child because you're constantly being reminded of the traumatic experience that caused that child, however much you love them. It can leave deep emotional scars that, if they're not healed, can just make it very difficult to empathize with the child, take care of its needs in the manner that you would have if it weren't born from a different circumstance. And so healing that trauma in the mother can certainly improve the circumstances for the child. That's probably the best case solution, actually, is being able to find a way to heal the behavioral health issues in the mother that can be a consequence of that type of trauma.
Sheila, I would say that the most important thing in that kind of scenario, which is one that I've dealt with before in my practice, is shifting the thinking from, I mean, once you've decided to keep the baby and you're going to embrace that child, the most impactful thing on the child is the attachment and the bonding that happens early on. So as Kyle mentioned, the quickest way to sort of begin that healing process is for mom to heal and to come to terms that this baby is not representative of that event and of that rape. This baby is an innocent, it's a product that can also be a gift down the road, and you can learn to love and attach. That's the most important thing, is that attachment and how you raise that child in a environment of love and nurturing. And that's the stuff that, if that doesn't happen, that's when you start to see long-term mental health issues from the lack of attachment and bonding. So I hope that helps a little bit.
That's wonderful. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for the call, Sheila. That's probably a different show, but great call.
It is. Yeah, that's really an acute trauma, whereas historic trauma tends to represent more chronic, long-term, drawn-out affair.
And but there are cases of systematic campaigns where women are raped. I think of Rwanda and some of the other places where part of the warfare is to systematically rape the children, the teenagers, and the women. And so you have whole generations of children. So that would be a historic trauma of a collective whole, if you will. So that's
Yeah, and a real act of genocide.
Absolutely. Okay. I guess right now we're at the halfway point in our show, so let's go ahead and take a short break. I want to remind folks that you're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection on KSK Anchorage. My guest today is Kyle Wark from the First Alaskans Institute. Our topic today is historical trauma. You can reach us at 550-8433 or call us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. And you can also email your questions to us at line1@alaskapublic.org. After this short break, we'll continue our conversation on historical trauma. I'm Prentice Pemberton.
You're listening to Line One from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line One on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Line One, Your Health Connection on KSK Anchorage. I'm your host, Prentice Pemberton. If you're just tuning in, my guest today is Kyle Wark from the First Alaskans Institute. Our topic today is historical trauma. As always, you can email your questions or comments about today's show to line1@alaskapublic.org. You can call locally at 550-8433, or our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. Please remember that the show repeats tonight at 8, so if you're listening to this on Monday evening, you'll be hearing a taped recording, and we will not be able to accept phone calls. Okay, I guess what I'd like to jump into a little bit is a little bit of the history of historical trauma as a field of study, and kind of how do we know that it exists, and when did this first kind of come into our consciousness as a as an area that researchers started to look at?
Yeah. Excuse me. Yeah, it seems that even PTSD didn't really become a psychological diagnosis until after the Vietnam War, kind of in the late 70s. And around that same time, researchers began to identify PTSD-like symptoms in Native American populations, African Americans, and other populations with a long history of oppression and trauma. But that term, historic trauma, didn't really become a field of study until about the late 90s. In 1998, Maria Yellow Horse Braveheart and one of her colleagues published the first kind of scientific article on something that they were calling historic trauma. And that really seems to be the marker for when the field started. And a lot of the work has continued in the early 2000s. There's around that same time, late 1998, 1999, the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study by Kaiser Permanente, the insurance company, also connected some specific childhood traumas, or what they called ACEs, Adverse Childhood Experiences, with later long-term health problems, including many of the same problems that have been associated with historic trauma, suggesting that ACEs is somehow related to historic trauma, maybe some sort of carrier, suggesting to me at least. There's also been, however, a lot of indigenous peoples who recognized that, you know, this history of oppression and discrimination and these types of things are having a long-term effect on their people. A lot of the medicine people in the lower 48, elders and things like that. Harold Napoleon published his book, Yoyurok, The Way of the Human Being, in 1996, where he talked about the effect of the Great Death on his Yupik people and how this history of plagues, probably the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic, affected his people, really created the sense of helplessness and powerlessness. It killed off the elders, who are the repository of wisdom. It killed off the medicine people, the shaman, what is it, Angakuk, I
think, in Yupik, who are the ones taking care of the sick patients. And so you lost this whole generation of knowledge. You had people who were horribly feeling what people call survivor's guilt. You know, why am I left when all these other people were saved? They turned to missionaries because those are the only healthcare providers other than, you know, dead medicine men that they could turn to, who said your culture is evil, this plague fell upon you because you're sinners, because you're dancing, because you're speaking your language. And alcohol was a net result of that feeling of loss and depression and oppression. There are even hints of it in the Alaska Native Commission in 1996. There were some Indian, lower 48 Indian anthropologist I was reading for my thesis who had similar comments as early as the 1960s. We did a survey with the Alaska Children's Trust asking people, what do you know about ACEs? When did you first learn about ACEs? And at least one of the respondents said, how did I learn about ACEs? Yupik culture. That was it. That was his whole answer. So it's something that we've been aware of for a long time. There are still skeptics that historic trauma exists or that historic trauma can explain all these problems that we attribute to it in Indian country, in other minority populations. But there's a lot of really strong evidence, especially from the field called epigenetics. Epi is like an ancient Greek prefix that means like over or around or on, usually something like on or over. And so epigenetics is something that happens kind of above and beyond what's going on with the DNA. It's happening over it or around it. And what it is little chemical markers that attach themselves to the DNA. So they're not a mutation. They're not actually changing the order of DNA molecules. They're somehow attaching to it and changing how that DNA is read by the cell. And so how it gets expressed. It can turn on or turn off genes is some of the language that these geneticists use.
So that indicates that trauma impacts us at a cellular level.
Yeah.
Sort of.
Yeah. And so there, you know, people who've gone through significant traumas in their lives get these chemical markers written onto their DNA, and that can even change their whole behavior. Like if they're traumatized as a child, they can have epigenetic changes that affect their behavior in adulthood. But these epigenetic changes can also be passed down to their children. So there have been some extensive studies of the DNA of Jewish people who were survivors of the Nazi concentration camps, and they found these epigenetic markers in the survivors, in their children, and even in their grandchildren. And I think one of the benefits for this type of study was just, you know, knowing who all the people were and having records of that. So those studies haven't always been replicated by other people. But you can see these genetic markers written onto their DNA that was affecting how they experienced stress, how they responded to stress. They had higher rates of PTSD than people who weren't children of survivors of the Holocaust and that type of thing. So there were real profound and measurable differences that you can find in these people's DNA. This historic trauma response has also been documented for, like I said, Native Americans, Alaska Natives, African Americans. Because epigenetic changes affect how your DNA is expressed, that can change your metabolism. So people who have this history of trauma or descend from traumatized peoples have higher rates of obesity, diabetes, heart disease, and even cancer. And because it affects how you respond to stress, that can lead to depression, anxiety, substance abuse, violent behavior, including suicide. And all of these problems are found at higher rates in populations with a history of major traumatic events, including American Indians and Alaska Natives and African Americans.
An organism that is raised in a state of chronic and acute stress chemically is different. Anxiety, I mean, it's sort of like brains are wired based on usage. Mm-hmm. And if you grow in a environment where you are afraid and not allowed to explore your freedom of expression and creativity and all those things, but your brain is wired essentially for survival.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that stress hormones and chemicals cause weight gain and all sorts of vulnerabilities to disease and other such things. So that's fascinating. And that leads right in, I mean, builds on the ACEs program. What did they find? What are some of the symptoms or the ACEs program, what did it demonstrate that exposure, based on the number of exposure to adverse childhood experiences, what that predicts for adult behavior?
Yeah. So the adverse childhood experiences study, because it was conducted in cooperation with a health insurance company, they had access to the entire medical record of their patients. So they knew what had happened to them in childhood. They knew how they developed in middle age, and in many cases, what their later life was. And they were able to catalog these 10 traumatic events. I don't know if I can remember all 10 offhand, but there were things like, did they experience physical, sexual, or emotional abuse? Were they physically or emotionally neglected? Were they exposed to domestic violence? Did a member of their household go to jail? Was a member of their household a substance abuser? Was a member of their household depressed or have these type of mental health issues? And I think there's another one that I can't remember. But they found that if they experienced one or more of these, there was a very significant percent that they would be more likely, like 30% more likely to be obese. I think you're like 700 times more likely to be an IV drug user if you've got four or more of those. And so what they found was a very direct, measurable outcome where depending on how many of those childhood experiences, didn't matter what it was, you could have been a child of an alcoholic who was depressed and went to jail. So there you've got three ACEs. But another person could have been exposed to domestic violence, emotionally neglected, and something else. So it didn't matter what traumas you experienced in this study. All that mattered was how many were you exposed to. And I think something like 60% of people in their study, and unfortunately I can't remember the numbers precisely, didn't have any of those. And they grew up and they had average outcomes in terms of obesity and diabetes and things like that. But even just having one of them tremendously handicapped you in terms of you are more likely to get these behavioral, mental, or physical health problems. And if you've got four or more, you are very, very disadvantaged. And that was kind of their cutoff, was one, two, three, or four. That's typically how it's measured, four or more. And if you've got six or more, seven or more, eight or more, you are more likely to. It's just that four or more is really the good cutoff.
Each exposure, I understand, and there's like a straight line graph of mm-hmm. exposures and future mental health problems, addiction, becoming somebody who's abusive. So mm-hmm. there's a straight line graph that each exposure increases is another vulnerability.
Yeah. And basically how it works is as you get exposed to these childhood traumas, it does apparently rewire your brain and you tend to either really over-respond to stimulus or really under-respond to it. So either you turn on and you're hyperactive and manic and you can't stop thinking and you can't pay attention, or you're completely shut off and you just can't think, can't move, can't talk, you're depressed, something along those lines. And being in these extreme emotional states floods your body with stress hormones, with adrenaline, with cortisol, with all these things that are great to have when you're being chased by a bear and you've got to run right. for your life. It's great if your car just fell off a cliff and you've got a broken leg, but you've got to climb up that cliff and go 10 miles into safety. Adrenaline and cortisol are going to get you to safety. They're going to save your life. But if you're undergoing that every day, for everything, because somebody said hello to you, because your teacher asked you a question at school, that's going to start wearing down on your system. That's going to start taking a physical and mental toll on your body, and systems are going to begin to shut down. Your blood sugar levels are going to spike. You're going to get problems with diabetes. Your metabolism is going to go way off, and you're going to start having problems with obesity because you've got that underlying unresolved grief, that unresolved stressor that's in your life that when you were a kid, you didn't know how to handle it. And you're still kind of stuck with that until you can get that resolved later in life.
People tend to either act out or act in.
Yeah.
Right? They take it out of themselves or they take it out on others around them.
Yeah. So, and they'll be turning to things like many people in these circumstances wind up becoming substance abusers because they're just trying to cope with these stressors that they don't have a good handle on. They don't have a good structure modeled for them in childhood, how to deal with these stresses, how to deal with those adverse problems that we all encounter.
All right, if you're just joining us, my guest today is Kyle Wark from the First Alaskans Institute. We are discussing historical trauma. You can call us with your questions or comments at 550-8433 or toll free at 1-888-353-8433. 5752, or you can email us your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. If you do have a question or a comment, I would encourage folks to get in here before I often get a lot of phone calls right at the end. And then I unfortunately can't get people on as we're winding down. So call now and we'll get you on the air with Kyle. Okay. Enough about the ACEs stuff, which is really, I guess, one more comment about that is obviously people and entire communities are exposed to a significant trauma over an extended period of time. And if you have a whole community of people that a high percentage of them are acting out or dealing with their stress with alcoholism and child abuse, and then it cascades down, and then their children are having ACEs and their children are having ACEs, and that's how that sort of perpetuates. So it seems silly to deny that collective historic trauma exists.
Yeah, and that's one of the issues that in my mind connects ACEs to historic trauma. Yes. A lot of the symptoms that ACEs produces are the circumstances you need to raise up a traumatized child, that you're more likely to have a child with ACEs if you've got a lot of ACEs in your own childhood.
The environment.
Yeah.
All right. Much as a whole lot's written about the Native American experience, can we talk a little bit about some of the examples of groups who've experienced this and what are some of the symptoms? What are groups of people symptomatically? We think about an individual, we look at the symptoms. What about groups who experience trauma? What are the symptoms? How do we know a culture has experienced some sort of collective trauma?
I think one of the ways that, you know, you can identify something like that, most of the time there are records indicating where these traumas happened. But if they've got disproportionate rates of these things, if they've got higher rates of incarceration among their people, if they've got higher rates of poverty, higher rates of low academic attainment, if they've got higher rates of, did I mention poverty?
Yeah.
Domestic abuse and these types of interpersonal violence, interfamily violence. There's a strong suspicion that something is going on there. And that can be a way of cueing in to finding out that there's this deep historical unresolved grief in them, like slavery amongst the African populations, like a lot of the Native American experiences with loss of land and boarding school and things like that, and other types of minority groups that have been oppressed, including LGBTQ populations, including women who often experience these types of oppression and discrimination and violence on a daily basis. There are types of historic trauma that can be identified there as well.
So we can look for statistical anomalies in things like incarceration and substance abuse, and those should give us a hint that perhaps there's some sort of historical trauma with a group of people. But
that healing that in this case, those issues are just symptoms of a deeper problem.
Right.
That you can't fix it by fixing their education or something, you know, fixing their approach to education. You really have to find out what the deeper problem is and how you can help them resolve that. Which
punishment
is often,
punishment is not the answer.
Yeah. Yeah, there's some sort of trauma that needs to be healed in there.
Okay, we got some phone calls coming in. I'm going to take them in order. Don, you're on line one with Kyle. Welcome.
Yes, thank you very much. I do appreciate every minute you people get me. I'd like to share some things with you. In particular, one book that came out, I think, back in 1968 was something regarding, you just said something about groups. People, and this was regarding the children and the survivors of Auschwitz.
Mm-hmm.
And the people, the professionals, had been tracking this particular group of people for like 20, 25 years, and they went back and double-checked on their status of the people. Who survived well, who adjusted well, who didn't. It was called The Wages of Neglect was the name of the book. I'm not sure who the author was on this. I believe it was a woman who was leading the team. At any rate, you get up around my years, and you've seen a lot of it anyway firsthand. And it is very shining examples of what to do and what not to do, the differences that a positive or a negative attitude can make. extremely important by educators, social workers, psychiatrists, clinicians, whatever, who a lot of times get carried away with their own little quirks and biases, and they tend to forget exactly what they're conveying to especially kids. And stereotyping, stigmatizing, whatever. And as any professional who's done some teaching, as I have in the past, you can sure make a big mess out of things just with opening your mouth with one or two sentences if you're not careful.
Mm.
Somebody takes it the wrong way, or you may not be trying to hurt anybody when you make a comment about their, you name it, eyeglasses, clothing that they're wearing or whatever, or their ethnic background, anything. And it may not be related directly to what you're trying to teach, but it may be taken that way because you don't know what that person has been undergoing at home or just an hour away in another setting at some part of school where there's teasing or bullying going on. And, yeah, we all need to, you know, watch our step, mind our P's and Q's, and be careful of how things get interpreted. I know some people that if you say good morning to them, they're ready to bite your head off.
All right, Don, I appreciate it. I got to get on to a couple more calls here, but those are some really good points about how important it is to be sensitive to what's going on with people and to not jump to conclusions and to stereotype and to stigmatize. So those are some really good points. Thanks for the call. Let's move on to Rory. You're on the air.
Hello,
Rory.
Hello. Good morning. Hello. Good afternoon, that is. Wonderful topic. Wonderful topic. I'm of Celtic and Sac and Fox and Paiute extraction, and I'm a practicing spiritual healer. And I find your presentation wonderful. This is a problem that's very problematic in many of our indigenous groups of people. However, there's something missing. You guys are talking about it, and it's great. You know, the Western psychological model is tremendous, and it has much wisdom. However, when you take cultures that were in harmony with spirit and in harmony with our earth, with our Mother Earth, and you destroy them and you cut them off from their identity and their connection to spirit and to mother and grandfather, then there's the healing is very difficult. And I think with Native peoples, there is an approach that could work and has worked. I've seen a tremendous success down in the lower 48 with using modern Western model therapies to deal with this cultural trauma, but also finding our roots back to our spiritual home, finding our ways back to not just a connection with our culture on a surface basis, but with spirit.
Rory, you make Rory. Excuse me a second. I think I'm going to have Kyle back to talk about the healing from historical trauma because you make some great points, and they are on our agenda of things to talk about, which we are not going to get to today. Because, yes, the reconnection to tradition and to the healing prospects here. I mean, the healing.
Because as Native peoples. Without the spiritual healing component, it's very, very difficult. It's very difficult because as Native peoples, we are part of our mother, and the spirit world is real, and it's part of the healing, and we exist in a world where the spirit exists. Everything has spirit.
Mm-hmm.
And if you ignore that, then I don't see how it can be an effective approach, at least in 100%.
All right,
so
Rory.
I'm going to say.
Thank you so much
for bringing this topic out. It's really important.
Uh-huh.
Kyle, can you speak briefly to what he's talking about?
Yeah, so fortunately, you do see a lot in the literature recommendations to use traditional healing ceremonies for helping Native American people and other minority groups returning back, you know, especially if you've got that sense of historic loss. If part of the trauma is a loss of language, a loss of culture, a loss of connectivity to your family and the way that you manage those relationships prior to those traumas, then the only way you're going to heal that is by reconnecting them to those things, by returning their language to them, or, you know, encouraging them to find their language again. Going through ceremonies to remove grief. In the Tlingit area, we have the Ku'ich, the invitational ceremony where you can invite people in to share food and remove grief from death. That's how it's most commonly used these days. Engaging in traditional healing ceremonies in the lower 48, the sweat lodge up here. I know that a lot of people talk about the maki, the steam bath. Those can be healing places where you can reconnect with other people, where you can hear stories, where you can heal those things inside of you that had been lost. And also engaging in traditional ceremony overall, like in the lower 48, again, the sun dance or potlatching up here. Those can be healing ways. Just being on the land, just spending time listening with elders, listening to their stories. There's a lot of research that suggests that if you've got a strong connection to your culture, a strong ethnic identity, and if you engage in traditional activities, those can be those can build resilience against a lot of these problems of mental health and behavioral health and physical health issues that can promote healing type behaviors and good feelings with your comrades and peers.
All right, Kevin's been waiting for a while. I want to get real quickly, Kevin. We don't have much time, but you got a question for Kyle?
Quick question. First, I'm glad you had this brought up as a cultural perspective. I've learned a lot here in this hour. With the topic of separation of children, is there anything in the literature or a movement or something more perhaps in the fore than perhaps in the past has been separation of children significantly from one parent or another during divorce? Here I'm referencing a topic called parental alienation, which is recognized. Does that have historical trauma implications for children when separations occur at a very young age and persist, of course, sometimes through majority, through 18 or 20?
I'll just poke at that real quick because I did a show on parental alienation a while back, which you could reference online. And you could find out a lot of information, but absolutely divorce has a traumatic impact and attachment on child development and trauma. And I know that, you know, children separated from their families and from their parents, either one of them has a significant impact. All right, Kyle, we are out of time. I'd like to very possibly have you back on and to discuss this further because it's a big topic. But do you have anything you'd like to leave folks with real quickly?
I think just trying to learn some of the history of Native peoples in this state, in this country, can really help us understand the real problem versus just these symptoms, these things that are the commonly seen as the problems, that it'd be worthwhile to continue looking into trauma-informed systems. So how, as an mm-hmm. educator, as a first responder, as a caregiver, or even just a retail person, you can understand what the people that you're serving may be going through and learn how to react to them better in a way that really addresses what's going on inside of them. To avoid stereotyping, because a lot of those times, historic trauma and these types of oppression can be perpetuated through stereotypes. So people talking about drunk Indians and things like that, not only is right. it not true, it hurts us.
Okay, my thanks to today's guest, Kyle Wark. Great information. Appreciate having you on the show. Humans all over the planet are living longer. But why this is true is often misunderstood. On the next Line 1, Your Health Connection, Dr. Thad Woodard and Dr. Jay Olshansky of the University of Illinois Chicago discuss why we are living longer and what it means to efforts to slow aging and prolong life. That's February 22nd at 2 p.m., repeating at 8 p.m. Pat Yak is the Chief Content Officer for Alaska Public Media. Dave Waldron is our web editor and audio engineer for today's show. I'm Prentice Pemberton. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.